Where the stale smell of Promethium and the revving chain swords meet, we are the home of rebellion on the Pirate Vox Wave 665.66 UHMA Chemrat Radio. Coming to you live tonight from the cracked Elysium, eagerly awaiting the sardonic serenade of the Electro-Death Trio born in Balefire.
And before our minds melt under the consistent assault of audio perfection, riots have spread across the Carastus Habstacks following last week's rampage in the Carastus Weapons Manufactorum. Viz Galita have locked down parts of the district in hopes of containing the violence before it spreads, and the Arbites are called in as a response.
Because one jackbooted thug is better than the other?
I am your savage guide through the post-apocalyptic wastelands of Audio Deviance, Goblin King. Joined, as always, by my co-host, the mass-accelerated mauler of Mayhem Alley himself, Marky.
What's up, dudes?
And always on the midnight prowl throughout the Frost Hollow, it's the polar bear, Shuckerfly.
Remember, get hopped up before you go outside.
Hopped up?
Hopped up before you go outside. Does it keep you warmer?
It depends.
Is that like a drinking thing? What are we talking about?
You might not feel the cold, depending on how much you got.
I'm not hip. Chuck, is this like a drinking thing or a drugs thing?
Yes.
Hopped up. It's like when you get hammered and take a bump.
A little bit upper, a little bit downer. You just go for it.
Just mellow out in the middle. Welcome to episode 105, Horus Heresy, The Coming Storm, Part 2. As we continue to move throughout the timeline of events of the Heresy, which we started to do in last episode, we'll hit some of these larger conflicts that require a deeper dive. However, unlike our coverage of Istvaan 3, Istvaan 5, and then Battle of Kalth, we're going to try to do these in order. And that's kind of where we are now with the events in the Paramar system. We're diving into these battles in a little bit more detail because they outline and really show off some of the more distinct flavors and differences between the legions, both those of the traitors and the loyalists. It doesn't necessarily feel fair on one hand to spend a lot of time talking about the Ultramarines and the Wordbearers and then sort of brush over today's subject, which is the Alpha Legion. Also, try to keep in mind and remember as we move forward that we're still in the early years of the Horus's...
The Horusi.
Also remember as we continue to move forwarder. God damn it, Marky.
Forwarder.
Yes.
Also, remember, the more forwarder we move into the Horus Heresy, we're also in the times of the early years. So there's a lot more going on, and a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, a lot of the stuff we talked about last episode took place between Istvaan 3 and Istvaan 5, and a lot of the stuff we're talking about today takes place as the blood is still cooling in the dirt of Istvaan 5 itself.
So speaking of flavors, what flavor of ice cream do you think World Eaters like? Are we talking cherry or like rainbow sherbet? I feel like that'd be World Eaters or Word Bearers?
I'm sorry.
Any of them. You know, I feel like sherbet would be like a very Thousand Suns flavor, you know? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
And you're saying cherry ice cream for World Eaters because it can run down your mouth red?
Yeah, we could say
that. I think it goes deeper than that. Like, cherries have kind of an iron taste, not an iron taste, like an ironish smell to them. They've got a very cherry smell to them as well, but they do have that edge of like kind of an iron smell to them. Mm. And blood has a very iron scent to it. So yeah, I imagine the World Eaters get down on like dark cherry ice cream.
I think Night Lords,
natural dark cherry.
Night Lords, I think, would be like a snow cone, but with actual fresh blood for the flavoring.
Foreskin flavored ice cream.
Yeah, can't you just see them there? They're at the pump, just like pumping it really hard. I need to get more of that in there. I want it just pooling on the bottom.
Who are we talking about today? We're talking about
the Alpha Legion.
The Alpha Legion. I feel like they're a pistachio, to be honest. Pistachio? You know how, like, yeah, because like when you look at pistachio, you're like, is that like lime ice cream? You're like, no, it's pistachio, you know, because it's like, you know what I'm saying?
It's a little tricksy.
I think they're like a Java fudge swirl where you look at the ice cream. I'm going to the same theme that you're going with. You look at the ice cream and you're like, oh, that's some that's some chocolate with some fudge swirl. I'm gonna get down on that. And then you take a bite and it punches you in the mouth because it tastes like fucking coffee. It tastes good, but you weren't expecting coffee. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
Yeah. But I dig that pistachio, because same thing. You're not expecting, even when somebody tells you it's pistachio ice cream, you picture a different flavor than hits your mouth.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah. How about you, Chuck? Alpha Legion's ice cream flavor.
How about what's that one? Cotton candy? Like, ice cream shouldn't taste like that.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. So the other Legion that's going to come up today are the Iron Warriors. Loyalist Iron Warriors. So what would Loyalist Iron Warriors taste like?
Rocky Road.
Why? I'm not disagreeing. Why? I want to know more.
It's just a feeling, you know? Like, you just can't explain it, because it's like they're soft but crunchy, you know, kind of like dropping a lot of nah means today. Just Rocky Road, man. I don't know how else to put it. All right, give me one that's better. If you think
I'm still thinking about you got me questioning my original gut reaction. Chuck, hit us with your Iron Warrior, your Loyalist Iron Warriors flavor.
Coffee.
Just flat out coffee.
Coffee, yeah, flavored, because
they got to stay awake to keep building and tearing down fortresses.
I thought they were siegers. Like they go and they siege. They're siegers. You know, they go and siege stuff.
Siegers.
Yeah.
Building and tearing down fortresses. So they just got to stay awake.
They're on that grind. So originally, I was gonna go with like Neapolitan, because it just feels like a very safe ice cream bet.
I agree.
And then as you guys gave yours, I was like, no, like a traditional Madagascar vanilla. But vanilla is a very, I think vanilla goes to ultramarines.
Vanilla bean. Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, ultramarine.
I feel like they're very vanilla bean flavored. Yeah. I agree.
Ultramarines are very vanilla bean.
Yeah. I love it.
But I think I would go with that. I don't know if you've ever had
that
it.
That makes salamanders chocolate.
No, because that's not why ultramarines are vanilla bean. It's because they're boring.
Well, I mean, chocolate is very like
salamanders
like comforting
would be like
flavor.
Hot. Salamanders would be hot tamale flavored. You know, hot tamales. Tamale? That yeah.
Is that a thing? An ice cream?
Oh yeah,
the spicy
yeah.
Cinnamon
the Mike and Ike's.
Oh. Yeah. That's salamanders right there. I feel like they'd be like a
Mango Nyaba. Mango Nyaba is like a Hispanic ice cream. They put like spice. They put like tahini and stuff in it. Tajin.
I know tajin. Good old tajin.
Yeah, I feel like they're very Mango Nyaba. Diablito, I think, is also what it's called.
Did you guys ever have Americone Dream by Stephen Colbert? It was a Ben and Jerry's flavor.
I didn't. No, I don't even know.
So it was
the meaning.
It was
the
like turtle ice cream. Turtle ice cream is like chocolate and vanilla mixed together with caramel and
chunks
and
of stuff. Yeah.
Sounds good.
And then Americone Dream was that, and then had chunks of like waffle cone in it. And now I'm thinking Iron Warriors, Loyalist Iron Warriors. I almost said Vanilla Warriors. Loyalist Iron Warriors would be chocolate, vanilla, fudge, and caramel with chunky waffle cone bits in it.
And then the traitor ones would be the same thing, but just thrown in a fucking gutter.
What? what's a Slaanesh? What's a Slaanesh Legion?
Emperor's Children.
That's the one. What are we going here?
Oh man,
banana split. Because you get the cherry and the banana.
Yeah, I like it.
And it's all smothered and covered.
Extra fudge.
I love it. That was way better than the one I was going to go with.
What were you going to go with?
I was going to say Cherry Garcia.
Cherry Garcia. I could see that too. We're going to have to, every time we come to a new Legion, we're going to do this. Our answers are going to change each time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Cause we're not going to remember. I know I'm not.
No. Cause we never write any of this shit down. I mean, the notes are written down, but our wild commentary is not. We do have transcripts. We could rely on the transcripts. Anyway,
let us know what your flavors are for your legions in our Discord.
Right.
That makes me afraid.
I think we should also start mixing in like where it comes from. So, you know, I picked Ben and Jerry's, a prestige ice cream, but maybe it's coffee ice cream from the gas station at 2:00 in the morning. Like, that could be it too.
It's just enough to get you by.
What is your favorite ice cream? Chuck, what is your favorite ice cream? Do you really not have an answer, like, just right off the top of your head, Chuck?
The two I bounce between all the time are cookie dough and coffee.
Okay. Okay. That's fair. Those are fair.
Oh, man. Cookie dough is good. How about you, Marky?
Me?
Oh, shit. You're asking me.
I'll go. I've got an answer. So mine, my favorite fucking ice cream is Thrifty Chocolate Malt Crunch. That is my favorite ice cream. Love it.
I go between cookies and cream and anything with like dark cherries, dark chocolate, and like fudge or caramel mix. I like a lot of the mixed ice creams. I don't know why.
Respect. Respect.
It's all that iron.
My fiance is a big fan of coffee ice cream. She loves coffee ice cream. She doesn't like coffee, but she likes coffee ice cream. It's really weird.
I'm the opposite. Can't stand coffee ice cream, but love coffee.
Yeah, I like coffee quite a bit. I'm entirely off energy. I have been only a coffee drinker for over a year at this point.
Nice. I'm sure at some point, probably after I pass a kidney stone, I'll probably stop.
I didn't want to get to that. I heard too many horror stories of people around my age who had all had kidney stones, and I was like, I'm gonna drink more water and less sugary drinks. Dude, now.
I've seen Green Mile. I know what's up.
You know it's coming.
Yeah,
I've done it.
All right, so let's jump into the first battle of Faramir in 006.M31. For a bit of context to its importance, the Faramir system lies at the outer northern edge of the Segmentum Solar, which made it a vital staging post and supply terminus for the Imperial Expeditionary Fleets during the Great Crusade. The Segmentum Solar being the segmentum that Terra is in the center of, or near the center of. It's not really in the center, but keep that in mind. The Faramir system is a trinary star system, which means that there's three stars that orbit each other in kind of an erratic pattern. And this meant that it had managed to capture 37 mineral-rich planets, and it sat on an unusually stable warp route on top of that. All of these things made it an incredibly vital waypoint for the Imperium's early years of expansion. In the early years of the Crusade, it was little more than a navigational marker in the Carta Imperialis, the Carta Imperialis being the mapping service of the Administratum. But it soon grew into first a largely automated Mechanicum outpost, and then as the Imperium's borders expanded into Segmentum Obscurus, it became a major supply base and fueling station. Segmentum Obscurus is just north of Segmentum Solar. The trinary stars of Faramir made even the system's habitable and semi-habitable planets undesirable, if not outright hostile, and no native or colonial population had ever existed there, leaving the system firmly in the hands of the Imperium's ever-growing military. Faramir 7 and Faramir 19 became penal colonies, with subsurface prison hives housing workers and production facilities. While one of the moons around the gas giant, Faramir 21, became a void station and fleet anchorage for the Armada Imperialis. This station, known as the Pharaon of Faramir, also housed the largest astropathic choir in the northern Segmentum Solar, and formed a vital hub of communication between Terra and the Segmentum Obscurus. The station was rigged with gun bastions and other void defenses, enough to rival the firepower of a naval battle group, making direct assault against it almost impossible. It'll get a little confusing, and I'm going to explain it now, and I'll try to touch on it again when we get there. The Pharaon of Faramir is a void base. It is also the title of the person that runs the void base.
Like a warden?
So, yes. So the Pharaon of Faramir is both the base and the warden of the station.
It's the title of the person Pharaon, on the planet, yeah.
Yeah. The Pharaon controls the Pharaon of Faramir, which...
Like the king of the kingdom.
Yes, yeah. It's the naming convention that sometimes 40K falls into, where you're like, you guys are using the same word over and over and over again.
The Emperor of the Empire. Faramir
21.
Yes. I'm sometimes my brain doesn't do Roman numerals very well, so I'm glad when I'm like, you're like 21. I'm like, thanks, Mark. And thank the assist.
All good. I'm here for the layups.
There you go.
Ryan does all the work, and I'm just kind of there to give a little you're love
just there
tap.
To get, you're just there to take the glory.
I wouldn't say that.
He said love tap, but he means that thing tap. When you come in and flick your buddy's balls really
yes.
hard.
100%. Oh. As Ryan's trying to take the layup, I'm like, good game. Sack tap.
Right in the sack.
Yep.
Can we make you fall and lose your kidney? Yep. Let's go.
Yeah, it's like, dude, you totally hit my left testicle there. Thank you. Like a sniper.
Orc sniper. Then there was Paramar 5 itself, an anomaly of the system with a structure that suggested the planet had been artificially engineered sometime in its distant past. It had once been a life-sustaining world, its topography clearly showing signs of ancient oceans, while its vast ecological reserves of hydrocarbons indicated that it had once been teeming with life. However, it had become a radiation-drenched wasteland, torn at by solar winds and tortured by extreme shifts in temperatures through its languid day and night cycle. Lastly, it possessed only a thin oxygen atmosphere, requiring rebreathers to process if you tried to live or operate on the surface. The dead world did, however, make the perfect planet for a military cache and supply base. It allowed the processing of promethium in vast quantities, while its massive subterranean caverns could be easily sealed and armored, turning them into subsurface bunkers which held many gigatons of arms and ammunition. The planet was given to the Forge Lords of Griffone by the Emperor as a reward for their service during the crisis of Hungerung Gyre and 891.M30, becoming a vassal domain of the Forge World Griffone 4, which the Mechanican ruled from the Paramar Nexus, which was a starport in the southern polar region of Paramar 5. Another thing I kind of wanted to touch on, just because I know it's come up in the past, so 40K exists in a very strange place because there's a lot of super technology stuff that we don't have, but a lot of the stuff that's represented on the models, especially like the Rhino and the different tanks and everything, are smokestacks and oil engines. And we talk about sacramental oil and we talk about the engines running on promethium or the flamethrowers using promethium, and a lot of the guns fire fling, or a lot of the guns are fling units. They fire solid projectiles. And there's kind of this anachronistic tendency of the 41st millennia. Promethium is essentially a new way or a new form of gasoline. It's like a hyper gasoline. The refinement process is up. They mix stuff in it to make it essentially a little bit more combustible and all of that. But promethium at the end of the day is a hydrocarbon, and a hydrocarbon being a fossil fuel. So promethium is, for all intent and purpose, oil. And any planet that processes or manufactures promethium is going to have all of the byproducts that the natural gas and fossil fuel industry in the modern world has, which is why we have things like plasteel, which is why somebody very jokingly said a while ago, there are so many purity seals in the Imperium, there must be entire planets given over to the production of honeybees so they can generate the wax, beeswax. And the truth is, modern wax is made out of paraffin. And paraffin, liquid paraffin, is a byproduct of the fossil fuel industry. So anywhere, any place that makes hydrocarbons, so refining hydrocarbon into promethium, is going to generate something like liquid paraffin. So you're going to have lots of candles. It's just something to keep in mind. It's very anachronistic because it's very common to assume, like, why don't they have, or to assume that they've got what's the game suit? Fallout style technology. Everything runs on nuclear engines, or everything runs on some new form of technology. And no, the reason that there's smokestacks on the Rhino is because the Rhino runs on oil. It runs on gasoline at the end of the day. The reason that the Orc trucks have exposed gasoline engines, they run on gasoline. It's just one of those things. It exists anywhere there's life that's broken down into a fossil fuel. That fossil fuel can be refined into something equivalent to modern gasoline in the 40K universe, promethium, and then that can be used to power combustion engines. In addition to increasing the prestige and power of Griffon 4 and its Magi, something that caused some contention with Mars, Paramar 5 also became a sub-bastion in Outer Forge for the Titans of Legio Griffonicus. Lastly, the system laid in almost a direct conjunction point between the Istvan system and Terra's Sol system, further cementing its potential strategic importance. Even as the blood cooled on the desert sands of Istvan 5, the War Master's eye had turned towards this new strategic prize.
So it's going to be...
he wants it because of all the production.
He wants it because of the production. He wants it because it's essentially a stepping stone between Istvan and Terra. He wants it because he can cut off Terra's communication to Segmentum Obscurus. Remember, at this point, Horus has made a bunch of moves to essentially isolate Segmentum Obscurus, or a chunk of Segmentum Obscurus, from the rest of the galaxy. It kind of holds a lot of different strategic value points, really.
And candles.
Yeah. It's one of those things. Like we talk about, I've thought it too. They obviously don't use gasoline anymore. They do use gasoline. They just call it promethium. Promethium is kind of the word that's used for combustible gasoline. It's the word that's used for, like, essentially super napalm. Promethium holds a lot of different properties in the 40K universe, but napalm is gasoline at the end of the day. But flamethrowers shoot gasoline. That's how they work. So the fact that there's promethium throwers essentially backs up the whole idea that promethium is some form of enrichment that either makes gasoline or a gasoline-like product, essentially. Got anything, Marky?
No, Chuck pretty much asked what I was going to say.
Gotcha. Felt like we cut you off there.
No.
Sorry.
Beat me to it.
I beat you to it.
Well, even we beat... Oh, yeah, because all those beeswax planets. Yes. I really do like... there's an explanation for why that doesn't have to be the case, but I really like the idea that there's literally just agri worlds that are bee farms for the Imperium's fucking... And then, purity seals.
And then when the bees die, they turn it into, protein bars.
Yeah, yeah. Bee paste. Bee corp space.
You seen those, those wasps that make honeycomb, but it's like red because they make their honeycomb off of like dead carcasses?
Yes. I wanted to say meat wasps, but they're not meat wasps. Maybe they're blood wasps?
Something like that. But I wonder if that could be like a purity seal thing. Purity seals are red, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually just blood mixed. You can make, that's the beauty about the Warhammer 40K universe. You can make anything super grimdark.
Right.
they're agri worlds that have been completely, every time they defeat anything from Khorne, they just drag it to the planet and drop it on it. And then the wasps use the carcasses of Khorne demons to make their honey.
That's their tithe. It's actually like humanoid wasp people. And like their tithe is fucking a huge like vat of red wax.
It's beast men, but they're wasps instead of.
I love it. That's fucking awesome.
I realize this isn't where you're going, but it made me think of it. And this is the last tangent before we continue. I promise. But you know the reason the Bacardi's logo is a bat, right?
No.
So in the 1700s, when rum was becoming a thing, rum is a relatively young drink historically. I'd say like 1600s. Rum is kind of America's drink. And America's drink not being the United States of America, literally the America's drink. It is the drink of the Americas. But they used to have problems. Most alcohol needs yeast to react. Whatever you're doing, you need yeast to react. Yeast breaks down the sugars, and that's what produces alcohol. That's the chemical process. So when they would have these big vats of sugarcane, of molasses, that were essentially being fermented into yeast, or not into yeast, into alcohol, sometimes the yeast process would kind of die off. The yeast would die off. So they would throw dead cats and dead bats and shit into the mash to jumpstart the yeast process. So the reason there's a bat on Bacardi's logo is because the Bacardi plantations in the 1600s used to actually throw dead animal carcasses into the mash in order to make the yeast process move along faster.
Wow. That's
there you go. It's a little dark, isn't it?
Chicago.
Think of that next time you drink Bacardi rum. Maybe there's dead cat in it. They don't do it anymore. This is not something that's happened since the Food and Drug Administration became a thing. But back in the day,
you're throwing what in your alcohol? And it's for flavor. Come on,
it's for flavor. It enhances the profile.
Anything that'll ferment, I'll put in there.
And Sam Adams, not Samuel Adams, but Sam Adams, originally tried to brew beer and sucked at it and ended up brewing rum. So that's another weird thing. And the reason that rum was such a prevalent drink in the Americas is because when you bought sugar, a lot of times there was a sugar tax. And the common explanation of the sugar tax, or the common thing that gets brought up when you talk about sugar tax, is that it's related to the slave industry. That wasn't necessarily true. The sugar tax was, for every like pound of sugar you buy, you have to take 5 pounds of molasses, because the sugar plantations couldn't get rid of molasses fast enough. At the end of the day, it all worked into the slave trade, so it all still kind of works. It's all still kind of the same idea. But the actual sugar tax itself was, for every pound of sugar you buy, you have to take so many barrels of molasses, because nobody wanted molasses, which now obviously we use in a bunch of different things. But rum is made from molasses, essentially. Anyway, none of that was really important, except Marquis said throwing dead bodies into beeswax, and it made me think of it. So there you go. The history of rum on a future podcast that we probably won't do. Under the Barrels of Madness, where we just get sloshed and talk.
Grab yourself a fungi beer and strap on. We're going in.
Well, even we've debated which of the Primarchs may have been a better suited match for the title of War Master. It's events like the First Battle of Paramar 5 that prove Horus was best suited for the position. His strategic genius laying truly in his ability to tactically respond when the plan didn't survive the first few seconds of battle. While the conflicts in the Istvan system had been overall traitor victories, they had not been flawless, nor had they gone completely to plan. The Imperium may have been late to get the full picture of the coming danger, but it was catching up fast, and the traitors had to move swiftly to seize control of vital strategic assets. Perhaps no other battlefield of the early heresy can Horus's tactical genius be as easily seen as it can be at Paramar. It had to be taken whole, not destroyed or left savaged, and this potential stepping stone on the path to Terra had to be secured quickly. He also couldn't risk taking it in mass, as the system was layered with bastions of defenses, nor could he risk moving his main strength against Segmentum Solar too quickly in the war. With the dregs of the fighting still dragging out on Istvan 3 and Istvan 5, neither the Loyalists nor the traitors had really proved themselves to be the eventual victor. Too much lay completely, potentially unknown. Also keep in mind that Horus is still mostly Horus at this point. The deeper threads of corruption that would twist his mind and feed on his expanding self-loathing and hate for the Emperor hadn't grown that much yet. So we're still seeing the shrewd and extremely intelligent Wardmaster, not the deranged shell of a man that would finally land on Terra. Paramar posed a difficult nut to crack, with both the Armada Imperialis and Mechanicum having forces in the system. If the battle went badly, it could become a protracted siege. It required subtlety and a certain amount of subterfuge. In this, Horus had his answer. The task would fall to the Alpha Legion.
This is their shining moment.
I almost feel like every time I say Alpha Legion, one of you should say allegedly.
Allegedly.
Because it's the Alpha Legion.
Allegedly send them in there. Maybe.
Which half possibly. Of the Alpha Legion? Allegedly.
Allegedly.
It's like the right. What is it? The right. No. What the hell is it? Twix. It's like Twix. You got the left Twix and the right Twix.
Yeah. Which factory do you go to?
Right.
So this is essentially after they've met with the Cabal too as well. Right? The Alpha Legion.
Allegedly at this point in the Horus Heresy, in this point of the timeline, the Alpha Legion has already been dealing with the Cabal. Yes. However, we haven't. The Cabal is like its own thing that we should probably talk about before we get too much deeper into all this shit.
I understand. They've already made their decision.
So the Cabal...
It's a funny-shaped ball that the Eldar like to toss around.
Yeah, the Cabal is a organization made up of several different Xenos species and human operatives that essentially knew that something was going to follow the Great Crusade and that it was going to be really bad. They knew before the Horus Heresy started that something like the Horus Heresy was going to happen. And because of that, they had started to make moves to essentially eliminate it. There was a Farseer in the Cabal, and I am massively paraphrasing. There was a Farseer in the Cabal who had essentially seen two outcomes for the universe because of the Imperium's Great Crusade, or the Emperor's Great Crusade. In one future, Chaos would win and take over the entire galaxy, and the entire galaxy would be enslaved for it all kind of falls into this weird thing where it's like either the entire galaxy becomes enslaved by chaos for 10,000 years or humanity slowly dies over 10,000 years. There were only like two options. And the Cabal essentially put things into play in order to make sure that the chaos forces didn't win in the 31st millennium and plunge the galaxy into 10,000 years of chaos. However, because it's this shady organization and there's all this kind of like conspiracy notion stuff wrapped around it, conspiratorial thought and everything wrapped around it, the contention is, did the Cabal win? And that's why Horus attempted to take over the galaxy and plunge the galaxy into 10,000 years of chaos reigning. Are we in the 10,000 years of chaos reigning? Or did the Cabal succeed and stave off chaos's arrival for 10,000 years? And we're in the period of 10,000 years that it's been staved off. Hey, getting any deeper into the Cabal and the conspiracy that follow or that surrounds it really requires its own deep dive, and we should probably do that before we get too much deeper into the heresy, because Chuck's right. There's a big question as to whether or not the Alpha Legion are good guys, bad guys, or Cabal guys.
Yep.
Not so much in the 40th millennium, not so much in the 41st millennium. It's pretty obvious that the Alpha Legion are just Chaos Space Marines, but yeah, the Cabal will play a bigger role the closer we get to the Siege of Terra. So Good point, Chuck. Thanks for reminding me. We will.
You're welcome. I'll be here till Thursday.
In the next couple of episodes,
I'll be here till Thursday. Tries a corpse starch.
Of all of the Space Marine legions that fell to his command, the War Master had none more suited for this task, save potentially for his own Sons of Horus. Angron's World Eaters were well on their way to being little more than savage berserkers. Conrad's Night Lords were similarly bent more towards terror and murder, not the types you want preserving the available industrial population of a system. Fulgrim's Emperor's Children may have also once been up to the task, but they were already twisting into an alien and stark contrast of what they had once been. Horus also needed to test the loyalty of those legions that had only been partially committed to the campaigns at Ishtvan, including the Alpha Legion. After all, nothing had proved loyalty faster in this evolving conflict than getting loyalist blood all over a legionnaire's hands. Alpharius's legion's motivations were always, and have always in some ways, stayed the most obscured. Just kind of talked about that. Horus was the only Primarch who could even claim to be close to the sinister and mysterious Alpharius, and even in that, not much trust could be found between these two Primarchs. However, the War Master had used the Alpha Legion to great effect in the later years of the Great Crusade, knowing when and where to commit them. While they had been at the Drop Site Massacre, they had cherry-picked their targets and victims, often as if they were settling their own scores over committing to any sort of general war effort. And so Paramar would be the crucible in which the Alpha Legion would be proven to Horus's side, paying as much with their own blood as they claimed in those of their enemies. As the last loyalist void ships fought desperately to escape the wreckage-choked space around Ishtvan V and the planet burned below it, the Azure and Smoke-holed warships of the Alpha Legion began to slip away, their attention focused on their new tasks. Only a token force would be left behind to witness the War Master's triumph on the killing fields of the Urgol Depression.
All right, so they're going in.
Yep.
They're going to be doing something
a little
shady.
They're sneaky about it, too. Yeah, they're real shady.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Every time I say Alpha Legion, somebody has to say allegedly.
You got to take a shot.
Oh, my God. Do not do that if you're listening.
Oh, definitely.
Oh.
You can allegedly take a shot.
Every time you say Alpha Legion.
No, no. The real drinking game is every time I read a spaceship's name, you have to take a shot. Don't do that either. There comes a point where there's a void battle between a couple of ships, and I keep saying their names over and over and over again. I'm just warning. Roughly half of the Alpha Legion fleet headed towards Paramar, even as many other vessels left
allegedly
on their own Espeon, on their own, damn it. Even as many other vessels left on lone missions of espionage committed to spread discord across the fracturing Imperium. In this battle fleet's wake came an armada of Dark Mechanicum Baresks and Mass Arks, set on the occupation and plunder of such a rich system. While alacrity was essential in their task, a headlong rush wasn't their way and could spell disaster. So like jackals, the Alpha Legion...
Allegedly.
I can't even remember where I was. Surrounded their prey and observed its strengths and weaknesses. The fleet broke into small groups and then single units, just at the vast star system's outer limits, relying on the trinary star's radiation and noise to confuse and mask their slow and silent approach. Gaining position in the system undetected, they spread out and encircled their targets, finding what they had expected, a state of heightened alert. Now came the dangerous game of when to strike. The longer they delayed their attack, the greater chance of either discovery or news of the drop site massacre reaching Aramar. Even with that, they had used the rising tides of warp swords to their advantage, positioning some of their own Legion assets in the choke points to even further isolate their target. But the longer they waited, the more time they had to observe and perfect their attack strategy, even as their assets spread further within the system itself, moving unseen past its defenses. Alpha Legion operatives and their mortal cohorts had already hijacked several transport ships and patrol vessels.
Allegedly.
This allowed them to weaken the system's outer defenses even more and gather more intelligence. Targets had been marked for assassination, like the Baron of Paramar, the title, the person, not the station, and other targets had been designated for sabotage, all designed to cripple their target's defense grid.
And this is supposed to be like Alpha Legion's bread and butter, right? Sabotage and
this is their
working
MO.
From the shadows.
They're not going to strike until they're assured that their plans are going to go without a hitch. They're definitely the espionage unit.
They're commando style black ops type deal.
Very hide in the shadows.
The system's prison hives, far from the Alpha Legion's two primary objectives, were of minimal immediate concern. These could also be easily mitigated with the use of time-release devices ready to release toxins and bacterial contaminants into their water supplies. The sands of time were running out for Paramar as the coils of the Hydra slowly crushed in on it. No longer would it hold the role it had in the Great Crusade or the optimistic dream for humanity's future. The strike came approximately 38 Terran days after the end of the drop site massacre at Istvan V. 11 warships of the Alphan Legion made real space transition at the edge of the Paramar system, in direct proximity to one of the standard Imperial shipping routes, which connected it to Terra. The Belisarius-class battle barge, Sigma Pythonis, then contacted the Pharaon of Paramar's central command directly, invoking the seal and orders of Rogel Dorn, the Primarch of the Imperial Fists and the newly named Praetorian of Terra. The ships demanded urgent resupply and aid. The Alpha Legion detachment claiming to have been swept off course by the turbulence of the warp, which had separated them from the larger Imperial task force that had been sent to Istvan V. With their authority accepted, the Sigma Pythonis and his escorts began to approach the Pharaon of Paramar, the void station, not the dude with the specific title, under the intent to make repairs at fleet anchorage, while the Belaforan-class heavy assault cruiser Annex Rho moved on towards Paramar 5 to pick up the needed supplies. No alarms were sounded, and under the flags of Brother in Arms, no suspicion was cast on the Alpha Legion. All while, at the very edge of the light cast by the system's three suns, the rest of their force crouched, ready to pounce.
It's about to go down. Something's going to happen, right? Right? Somebody's going to die?
There were like three times where I thought to fake you out by being like, and that's where we'll pick back up. That was one of the places. I'm like, if I do it to Marky here, I wonder if he'll lose
really
his shit.
Really hating all of these cliffhangers.
I know.
So getting me, tell me this giant strike force just kind of slips in and hides.
Oh, yeah. Nice and deep like.
The rest of their battle fleet is essentially just kind of hanging at the edge. Well, they start at the edge of like Auspex and Augur range, and then they essentially just use the radiation of space and the stars to slowly drift in. So no one really thinks anything about them. And they're not really coming in that deeply. They're kind of more
only coming on the outside.
The entire system. Yes, Marky.
Yeah.
Coming on the outside.
That's right.
So they're essentially just waiting for that money shot.
They penetrate real deep and stealthy while the rest kind of just come on the outside.
And this is a really dangerous place to be in because these 11 ships are, you know, no one knows they're bad guys yet, but It's that whole idea of like, you know, pick a movie where this happens, where the good guys sneak into town past all of the bad guys.
It's Wrath of Khan when they're not answering the comms. And they're like, we're one big happy fleet.
Right, right.
Surprise gangbang. I think that's the tactics that we're going to call the Alpha Legion.
The Alpha Legion, allegedly. The alleged tactics.
It's not what I signed up for, but I'm here, so it's happening.
Yeah, getting a paycheck, you know.
It's one Magos sitting on a couch, and behind him there are seven Alpha Legionnaires.
Exactly. Like, it's all right. I get paid by the hour.
Just give me a couple more creds, and I'll be good to go.
Wow.
They bought him a fungi beer beforehand. There you go, little buddy.
Give me some of that bat flap beer. We'll be good to go.
The bat flap? And we should do a frost. There should be a frost bat rum. As the old saying goes, no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. And in this case, Bait was just as willing to unravel the Alpha Legion's plans. As the Sigma Pythonis and its escort fell under the watchful shadow of the Pharaon of Paramar's defensive corridor of guns, and the Annex Rho came within light minutes of Paramar 5, reality split once again, and five vessels unaccounted for in the Alpha Legion's plans and not belonging to the Legion made real space transition. The traitorous Stardust warriors kept their cool, however, sticking to the plan as if nothing was amiss. The Alpha Legion ships began to hail these five unknowns, led by a capital-class void ship using the standard set of Vox challenges, even as they still moved through the shadow of those impressive and deadly guns. Then picked images of their long-range ocular scopes revealed the newcomers as slab-sided hulking monsters of black seared steel, the silhouettes of Imperial pattern hulls barely visible under the layers of improvised armor plating and studded with 15-meter-long anti-boarding spines. At last, the Alpha Legion's Vox challenges were answered, with something bordering on indifference. The lead warship of the newcomers identified itself as Tyche's Lament. Tyche's Lament? Tyche's Lament?
Tyche's Lament?
Tyche's? I think it's supposed to be Tyche's Lament.
All right, the little Tyke.
I don't...
The little Tyke.
Right. The lead warship of these newcomers identified itself as Tyche's Lament, flagship of the 77th Grand Battalion of the Iron Warriors Legion. Its master, Kyre Valen, responded that he cared not for the Alpha Legion's orders. He was here for his own purposes, a completely unexpected result, and while both the Alpha Legion and the Iron Warriors had sided with Horus at Ishtvan V, there was no love between the two legions. Had the Iron Warriors been sent on the same mission as the Alpha Legion, as some part of Horus's distrust, or were they there to aid or act as watchdogs in case the Alpha Legion failed to carry out his orders?
And so these new ones came into real space, like right when the Alpha Legion got the okay to come in.
So the Alpha Legion is within the gun corridor approaching the Armada void anchorage. So there's all of these guns that are essentially pointed outward, and the Alpha Legion is moving through that incredibly dangerous part of space. And as that's happening, these Iron Warrior ships appear on the edge of the system. And the Alpha Legion immediately starts hailing them, like, who are you? What are you doing here? We've been sent by the War Master Horus to resupply. They're playing it cool. They're not revealing their hand, but they're trying to basically figure out who these guys are and why they're there. Because it's a fly in the ointment. It's not accounted for. They weren't in the plan. They're not supposed to be here.
It's a surprise.
Yep. Worse, could they be some rogue element that would need to be dealt with? And were these five ships their total strength, or were there more waiting in the vast darkness? It mattered little, for at this point, the Alpha Legion was far too committed, and the unfolding events were about to take on a momentum all of their own. Both contingents moved ever forward. On the Alpha Legion's vessels, legionnaires waited in full battle plate for the order to be given, while their vessels' weapons waited cloaked and hidden from the Pharaon's auguries, ready to spit lightning death. Finally, the Sigma Pythonis came to rest a few kilometers from the void station's outer docking bays, and a single Thunderhawk gunship made its way from the Alpha Legion's vessel to the station. Stepping down the ramp at the head of their delegation was a figure that held a pale spear like a staff of office, its ornate worked armor glittering in deep sea blue greens, and a scaled cloak moved about it as if it had a serpentine mind of its own. The stunned Mechanica, Magi, and deck officers whispered among themselves. Alpharius, it's Alpharius. A Primarch is here. He's moving among us. The towering figure demanded to be escorted to the master of the Phaeron and was obeyed, even as the delegation had been met by the Commandant, Independent, Magos Shipmaster, and Preceptor of the Astropass, along with their various staff. No dignitary of the Phaeron would dare to decline a Primarch. They had knelt before this son of the Empire in supplication. That is when the first alarm klaxons began to wail, and even before the first mumbled apology could leave the Commandant Intendant's lips, Alpharius turned the deck into a ruin of red mist. At the same time, the guns of Sigma Pythonis broke their silence, and much too late did the Phaeron of Paramar discover it held a knot of vipers too close to its breast.
We're all one big happy fleet.
So he was like a super towering short guy?
Alpharius is the shortest. No, I think he might be the second shortest.
So from what I can remember reading, is Alpharius and Omega are a little bit taller than a Marine. So that's why a lot of times their own sons run around acting as them because they're twins. Their genes got split. I thought
Alpharius was the shortest and that he was about the size of a normal space Marine. So you could almost walk among them. Like,
yeah, that's essentially the thing. Yeah. But he's still much bigger than, he's still going to be much bigger than
person or a Magos. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you see Alpharius and Omegon among their own Marines, they're like a head taller than them. I think it's the difference where the other Primarchs are a head and shoulders taller than a Marine. So you can definitely tell, even a Marine has to kind of look up to them and look up to them, as to where I'm about a head taller than my fiance and she doesn't really have to look up to me. But I'm definitely taller. You know what I mean? And yeah. I think that's kind of Alpharius and Omegon are definitely taller, but they're not as tall as a Primarch. Yeah. They don't stand out as much. They could just be a really big Marine.
There's plenty of those.
Yeah. But at the same time, these dudes all took a knee. Essentially, Alpharius walks down from the ship and demands to be taken to the Phaeron, and all of these guys take a knee to go, of course. And at that moment, these alarms go off and Alpharius strikes. Doesn't wait to see what's going on. He just goes, okay, this is it. This is the time to strike. I'm not going to wait until I'm in the heart of the ship like I had wanted to. I'm going to go now. And at that same time, as if timed with it, the Sigma Pythonis opens fire.
Okay.
And we'll find out why in a second.
Okay, I was going to say, not as stealthy as I thought they were going to be, but I'm assuming there's reasons, right?
Yeah, it's that moment in a stealth game where you go, okay, it's time to go loud.
That's a bad example because that's pretty much every time for me.
Yep, same here. There's always a point in a stealth mission where I go, fuck it, I'm going loud.
Yeah,
it's a point, usually the mission where you can no longer be a box.
Yep.
Yeah, it's usually the first 30 seconds for me, and I'm like, yeah, no, fuck this. I got to be somewhere in an hour, and it's not going to be sitting here slowly walking my way across the map. Motherfuckers need to get out of the way.
Right. I don't know if you guys ever played Payday 2. It was like a heist game where you play bank robbers. You play robbers in like a team. There's always a point in that where it's too late. Somebody hit the silent alarm and you didn't stop them. It's too late. It's time to start shooting. This is totally that moment.
Or you're that person when you're playing the stealth mission and all your friends want to do the stealth mission. You go, oh, look, pop. I guess we're not quiet anymore.
This is a stealth game?
I can't even imagine playing a stealth co-op game with Marky.
Yeah, no. There's
I would just be shouting the entire time.
There'd be, yeah, pretty much. There's no such thing as a stealth game for me. Sorry. It's not going to happen.
Within seconds, the guns of the Alpha Legion speared through the station, ravaging defensive and offensive systems. Even as boarding craft and the howl of teleporter shockwaves sounded throughout, the Sigma Pythonis escort joined its fury, their weapons tearing through the helpless Imperial ships still held at anchor. Even as Kazastus assault rams and Dreadclaw spat from their launch bays, confusion swallowed the outer defense network as the systems failed. Orders died before they could be sent. Power systems died, and targeting data was garbled so badly that defense weapons couldn't target a single thing, instead just spitting their ordnance into the emptiness of space. The Azure power armored Astartes tore through the defenders of the Pharaon Void Station, shredding what little resistance they encountered. Anarchy had spread even before they assaulted, the officers who had been in charge of such resistance being assassinated or poisoned in their quarters before Alpharius had even struck. In a solar hour, all that was left was the cleanup as they took full as in a solar hour, all that was left was cleanup as the Alpha Legion took full control. The Bastion gun line could only watch helplessly as the station and anchorage fell, their own weapons useless against an enemy that was already inside. The Pharaon of Paramar now belonged to the Alpha Legion. So all of those guns were pointed out. They were all pointed out system. So as soon as the anchorage fell, as soon as the Alpha Legion ships got past it within that like inner docking area, none of those guns could be brought to bear against the Alpha Legion. They could only fire on things out system. And as soon as the Pharaon of Paramar fell to the Alpha Legion, all of those guns were essentially just, we'll tick them off as we can, but they're all under our control now. We can now shoot at anybody we want to coming in.
So it was like they were stealthy up to a point, right? To the point where it's like, all right, we're out of the severe danger zone. Now we can just deal with what we need to get this job done. It almost sounds like they were rushing. Am I wrong in saying that?
They got, so a bunch of things kind of all happened at once. The big one is that all of the Alpha Legionaries and all of their like mortal cohorts who had snuck into the system beforehand had assassinated all of their targets. So, you know, as you're assassinating or poisoning people, there's always that chance. Every single person, just like in a stealth game, every single person you assassinate silently, there's a chance you're going to get spotted. There's a chance somebody's going to set off an alarm. I know this is a weird example, but Far Cry 5, you can like stealth take out or first person shoot your way through all of the guards at any of the different cult stations that you come across. Yeah. And I got really into like specifically taking out as many as I could through stealth because the stealth kills are just fun. And it's always a risk. You know, if you're taking out a dude standing on top of a tower, there's a bunch of guys who might see you. And I imagine that this is kind of the same way as these Alpha Legionnaires are assassinating their targets. And as the mortals that they've spread about are like poisoning people, every single death is a chance at discovery. So I think the big thing was they knew that they needed to get these 11 ships in close enough to the station that they could just take it. And as soon as they got to that point, it was, all right, launch everything. Like, just overwhelm the fuck out of them. Don't let them get a chance to fight back. We're already here. And the way that a lot of these Mechanicum systems are set up, and again, this is a Mechanicum-run system. This system is being run by the Forge World of Griffon. As soon as you take the hub, you own everything. So as soon as they took the Pharaon of the Pharaon of Paramar and took down the Pharaon of Paramar, as soon as they had the control bridge, they owned all those guns. There may have been mortals that were tasked to work there, like tech thralls and stuff that were tasked to work there.
Yeah, but the risk is minimal.
May have put up a resistance, but those servitors are just going to turn on them and murder them because the servitors now answer to the Alpha.
Yeah. Okay. So it was basically the best time for them to strike.
It was the perfect time. I can't remember what codex we covered in the, maybe it was the Eldar codex, but there was a point where we were going through it and like everything was like, and the warp spiders know the perfect time to strike and the fire dragons know the perfect time to strike. And I was like, okay, can we say something other than the perfect time to strike? Not everybody can be.
This is the perfect opportunity to hit.
I mean,
just change the words a little bit.
You're Eldar, so it's always the perfect time, right?
Right. Whatever. What's Gandalf's thing? A wizard is never early or late. He arrives precisely when he intends to.
Exactly.
The Alpha Legion, when they're penetrating your defenses, they arrive precisely when they want to, or they penetrate. Precisely when they want to.
To the depth that they need to. I just imagine at the frat level, you know, if you were to reduce all of the Primarchs to fraternity brothers, Alfarious is the one going around the frat house putting holes in everybody's condoms. He's like, Horace will never see it coming. Poke.
There goes his future.
Omegon. Omegon is spiking the punch downstairs. I think, like,
was
anyway.
It, was it Blue Mountain State? It's like Thad or something like that. He's Thad.
Oh my god, dude, those old, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking those old, like, kind of terrible 80s movies that wouldn't be capable of airing today because of,
yeah, no joke,
40 years of progress.
Yeah, it's a show me the rubber that you're gonna put on my quarterback's winky.
You guys watch Community, right?
I've seen some episodes, yeah, but I haven't watched a lot of it.
They branded, they have a STD festival where, like, the entire point is, like, do safe sex, don't catch STDs. And the running gag is that the dean is, like, a well-intentioned idiot. So he brands all the condoms with Greendale. And he's like, how was I to know that printing the word Greendale on the condoms would make them fail so easily?
Oh, geez.
It was just there's just all sorts of things that show makes me laugh. Anyway, above Paramar 5, however, the Tykes Lament and the Annex Row now vied for position, each claiming that their emissaries should be the first received and that their demands should be the first met, a conflict that the Mechanicum stoically refused to get involved with, as always claiming neutrality. So the Mechanicum did this a lot when the Space Marines tried to vie for position, and this happened in the Great Crusade. This is just a thing that the legions did with each other, and chapters do it in modern 41st millennium. That whatever chapter it is, whatever legion it is, they always think they're the best. The Mechanicum always has kind of adopted this, like, we're gonna let y'all figure it out. Even when the Space Marines are like, right, we're your buddies, we work with you more, the Mechanicum's like, we're not getting involved. Y'all figure out your own bullshit. And whoever you decide needs to go first is who we'll talk to first. We're not getting involved.
So they're kind of like the dude, Benny from The Mummy, right?
Just pulling out different charms.
Yeah,
to bring.
They're just like, I'm on the winning side.
Yep. Yep.
They're just right. Like, I'm on the winning side. If you're way, what was the quote that he said? Your strength brings me strength. He's just
brings me strength. So in this particular case, the Mechanicum is not getting involved in the argument between the Alpha Legion captain and the Iron Warriors captain. The attack, this is happening at the same time as the ships are arriving at, that the attack has not started yet at the Pharaon of Paramar. This is essentially, as those 11 ships are moving into range, this thing is happening elsewhere. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
It's all happening at the same time. It soon became apparent that the Iron Warriors battle group, all of them moved to Paramar 5. None of them went anywhere different. Knew nothing of the drop site massacre, or even that their legion had sided with Horus. The 77th Grand Battalion had been operating on its own for more than 40 years on a seemingly endless campaign of suppression in the Therakon Wastes region. Valen, the Iron Warriors commander, had returned to Paramar for exactly what he claimed, just resupply, as he had many times before. So this particular Iron Warriors fleet came back to Paramar 5 all the time to resupply. This was like a common trip for them. This is bad timing. This is that,
yep,
your plans never survive first contact with the enemy. There's something you're not accounting for that's going to happen.
Like we talked about in the past, probably they're primarily Terran Iron Warriors.
The Therakon Wastes region is essentially this kind of shitty part of space that's just absolutely beset by a bunch of different Xenos races. And the Iron Warriors that were there were just constantly besieged, which is why their ships were these, like, overly armored, extra slabbed monstrosities. These were not, they looked as close to chaos ships before the term chaos ship existed as you could get. And that's one of the reasons that the Alpha Legion kind of assumed that they had been sent by the War Master. It's at this point, during this argument, that the captain of the Annex Row realizes, oh, these dudes are loyal. These dudes are not traitors. They know nothing of what's going on. And Valen claimed that his rights wouldn't be denied and that he should be resupplied first, regardless of what the Alpha Legion's orders were from the War Master. So again, you know, the Annex Row is saying, well, we've got orders from the War Master, and the and Valen's like, I don't fucking care. I have orders from the Emperor. I understand that the War Master is now in charge, but the War Master is not the person who gives me my orders. My orders came from the Emperor. Like, it was that level of, like, staunch argument between the two of them.
I fucking love it.
But there's still, you know, as far as the Iron Warriors are concerned, they still think that the Alpha Legionnaires are loyal. Because they don't know anything about the Void, about the Drop Site Massacre. They don't know anything about anything that's happened.
That's what I'm saying, too. Like, you've brought up in the past, like, these Iron Warriors, the majority of them are probably from Terra as well. And they got their orders from the Emperor. So, like, that's fucking great.
Well, and we talked about it when we talked about the disposition of the legions before we started the Coming Storm series that we're on now. There were units, this being an example, there were units that were so separated from their legions that they had, that when they came back from whatever job they were doing, whatever side they arrived at, they were like, well, fuck, I guess this is who I'm with now. Like, you know, because they were, and it happened on the other side. Units that had been separated for 40 to 60 years, even of potentially Terran-born Space Marines, would return to the War Master's side because that's what their orders said. And then they would engage in these battles. And by the time, like, two or three battles got done and they went, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? It was too fucking late. They were already embedded in this new war. They had already, through action, picked a side. And that's sort of what's happening here. These probably Terran-born, or at least heavily Terran-born Iron Warriors, at the very least, Iron Warriors that don't know Olympia has been destroyed at this point in the timeline, show back up to resupply so they can turn around and go back to their war zone. And they've got no fucking clue that anything other than the Great Crusade is happening. And that's just, I mean, it's year six still. It's 38 days after the Drop Site Massacre. So, you know, but yeah, I love the idea of Terran loyal Iron Warriors. It's very cool to play around with all of these, like, offshoots and splinter groups. This argument had delayed the captain of the Annex Row for too long, as Auspex returns on Paramar 5 began to pick up the distant echoes of heavy weapons fire at the Pharaon. With that, his hands had been forced, and the Annex Row ended their argument with the Teich's lament by unleashing a fusion warhead torpedo on the Iron Warrior's warship. And as atomic fire engulfed the Iron Warrior's battleship, the Annex Row assault bays disgorged wave of heavy Caradus assault claws towards the Paramar Nexus on the planet below. The Mechanicum reacted to the sudden violence above with astonishing speed, but even that was too late, as their shields sealed above the descending landing craft. Wreathed in flames of re-entry, the assault claws slammed into the upper towers of the Terminus Panopticon, their blade grapnels smashing through the hardened ferrocrete as they began to burn their way within. Above, the Annex Row pressed the attack, its dorsal lances pounding the Iron Warrior's escorts, while its main armaments, built for orbital assault, began to rain titanic shells on the still flickering into life shields below. Cluster warheads and torpedoes adding to the weight of its full onslaught, overwhelming by brute force what had been denied to their subtlety. A second assault wave stood ready, watching for a flicker failure of the shields below. The Terminus could still be taken and Paramar 5 secured. Meanwhile, Teich's lament reeled in its shroud of molten and burning debris, but then it began to turn on its own power. The Iron Warriors had not expected battle. Their guns had been empty and their weapons powered down when the sucker punch of atomics had smashed into them. But even without its shields fully powered, it was far from defenseless. Meters of armor plating had been turned into superheated plasma by the fusion torpedo's strikes. However, the Forges of Olympia had built their ships to withstand worse, and the armored core underneath was barely scorched.
Yep, so even surprise attack, they don't care.
Yeah,
well, shit's falling apart, it sounds like.
The warp, or not the warp, the in-system, like, radar signatures of the greater battle hit this argument. And in that moment, the captain of the Annex Row is just like, well, fuck, now I have to launch weapons. So I imagine during this entire argument, when he's trying to feel out Valen, he's just like, he's asking leading questions, he's trying to figure out, and his hand is just hovering over the big red button. And then somebody on his command staff goes, the attack's happening at the Pharaon, and he goes, well, fuck. And he just pounds his fist into the button. He's like, fuck it. I guess we're going again. The time for subtlety is over. Now it's time to attack.
For sure.
Although it's far from clear, Imperial records suggest it was Warsmith Kyre Valen himself who threw his steerman aside and triggered the colossal engines of the Iron Warrior battleship into life. Without his ship's targeting aspects and blinded by the flames and burning plasma that still engulfed the ship's prow, he plunged the Tychus Lemet at the Annex Row, like a 7-kilometer-long burning spear. Locked into its firing solution on the planet below and the wounded Iron Warrior's escorts it was keeping at bay, the Alpha Legion ship could not recover in the scant minutes before the Tychus Lemet crossed the distance between the two. The Iron Warrior's ship struck the Annex Row from directly below amidship, shattering its void shield and smashing it aside in a hail of debris and vented atmosphere. The heavy assault cruiser, also built to take massive amounts of terrible damage, survived the impact, at least barely. It now spun out of control, its engines thrust firing and taking it out of orbit as it attempted to escape the scarred monster of the Tychus Lemet, which had begun to turn for another attack run. Meanwhile, in the Panopticon below, the Mechanicum was being torn apart by the Alpha Legion's Terminators, which shredded the barricades and bulkheads one after another. Power fists crushing, even while Balter's shell and plasma blasts siphoned through the tech thralls who still stood at their workstations, blindly carrying out their daily tasks. The azure-clad traitor Astartes relentlessly advanced. The objective of the Panopticon,
allegedly.
Eric's chamber. What's up? Oh, allegedly. The objective of the Panopticon Nerex chamber, from which the Terminus and the entire Nexus facility could be roused to war or pacified. Again, the Mechanicum has all of these systems in place where one person or one control room can either bring all of them into war footing or turn everything off. And they know if we can get to that room and turn everything off, we have the Nexus, we have the Panopticon, we've got a foot into the planet, and the rest will fall easily.
Allegedly, as Marcus says.
What the invaders encountered in the Terminus Panopticon did not match any of their intelligence reports, however, as it was more a labyrinthine machine, labyrinthian. You are correct, labyrinthian. Okay. It was more of a labyrinthian machine onto itself, a construct meant only for the minds of those dedicated to the machine cult. It was the brainchild of Archmagos Sarian Nihon, the master of the Paramar Nexus, and it had begun to respond like a living body responding to any invading hostile microbes. First with a sluggish response, but it only picked up speed and increased in its untiring force. The thralls of the Panopticon disconnected themselves from the machines and began to throw themselves against the Alpha Legion attackers, heedless of how they died in the hundreds. But their dead soon began to slow the azure-armored Terminators, forcing them to expend time and ammunition on this onrushing horde. Then the walls and the bulkheads began to slide and rearrange themselves, not randomly, but with the intent to confuse and scatter, at times separating Legionnaires or trapping them in improvised prisons which needed to be torn apart by Chain Fist and Power Claw. Consoles and power junctions would overload and explode as the Terminators neared them, and deck plates became charged with lightning, or mechanical tendrils shot out to ensnare and drag them down. Even entire sections of the floor would fall away in sudden death shafts. And with all of this, the Alpha Legion began to slowly die. Alpharius's sons were nothing if not intelligent and ruthless, however, and they saw this attack for what it was, and they began to fight against it, banding closer together and cutting a path through the shifting maze, which alone would have probably done little more than slow them. This was just a prelude, as things awoke in the darkness below as the Panopticon and the Beast of Steel rose up to meet their prey.
So they're not like the best in just brute force, blunt combat, right?
That's not what they super excel at, but they're still Terminators and they're still space marines, right? Yeah.
It's just a weird labyrinth now. Yeah.
Labyrinth death trap.
And it's shifting on purpose around them. And they weren't winning until they realized what was happening. Because at first it's like, oh, that was a weird coincidence. Oh, that was a weird. And then it's like, wait, this is happening on purpose. And then they're like, okay, if we create a spearhead and we move forward, nobody stand on the same floor plate at the same time. Everybody be within like hand grip of the next guy so you can be pulled up if something happens. And instead of dealing with trying to walk down these hallways, let's just cut a direct path through all of these fucking walls we already know we can tread through. And that's what they started doing. They just started cutting a line through the facility. They're like, fuck playing your game.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they had to play with the power of voodoo.
Voodoo.
Power of the babe.
Castellax class and Varax class battle automata appeared from hidden bulkheads directly into the battle, roaring binary war cant in the distorted voices of the damned. Servoclawed arms with the strength to pulverize tank armor smashed down or rent terminators slowly limb from limb. Even as bolt cannon and plasma blaster roared at point-blank range, power claws severing machine limbs and toppling the hulking engines of destruction. Soon the battle became a score of desperate and savage melees, the panopticon shaking to the thunder of tortured metal and the superhuman violence, blood and machine fluids running in rivers through its vaulted chambers. But inexorably, the Mechanicum's battle automatons began to claim the upper hand. Fresh ranks of the engines of destruction would rise up to replace any that fell, while the Alpha Legion strike force, once numbering 200 Terminators, was dwindling by the minute. The rest of Paramar V had also awoken to the danger it now faced, as in the skies above, the two wounded ships, NX Ro and Tykes Lemet, now circled each other like wounded beasts, trading sporadic weapon fire. The Alpha Legion ship keeping the other badly damaged Iron Warrior escort ships at bay with its lance fire. It was then that a dozen burning lances of light struck up from the planet below and tore into the Annex Row, turning the Alpha Legion's warship into a burning star in its final moments. While the first attack on Paramar V had been overcome, there was little cause for the Mechanicum or the Iron Warriors to celebrate, as their long-range auguries began to return the clear pings of hundreds of new vessel drive signatures now on a direct course for the world.
They getting fucked up pretty bad. It didn't...
They won. They fucking destroyed the Alpha Legion of one ship, but
now there's more.
Now of the rest. Now all those ships that were waiting in the darkness. Yep.
Okay. Well, this is the coming around. This is the initial one that came in, not the ones that are.
Yeah. You know, so 11 ships originally came in. 10 went to the Pharaon of Paramar and took it. One went to Pharaon's 5 to drop Terminator. And essentially, we're going to drop Terminators in the Panopticon. We're going to take the Panopticon. And as soon as we have the Paramar Nexus, we're going to control the planet. We're going to be able to turn off all the defenses. And then our ships can move in slowly and we can take everything. Because at that point, other than like the Skitarii rising up on Paramar 5, we're going to have nothing to fight. Because it's a bunch of penal. It's penal legions.
Yeah, it's a colony. Penal colony. Yeah,
even if there are penal legionnaires there, they're not going to be a problem for space marines.
For sure. Especially Alpha Legion, where they can all infiltrate and work in small. Yeah.
Especially when you control all the guns in the system now and you can point them at all those planets and just not let ships take off.
Well, I mean, yeah. I was going to say, they don't want to fuck the planet up too much because that's what Horus wanted, right? He wanted them to...
He wants the production.
Yeah.
This is definitely one of those. I want you to take shit with as little damage as possible. Obviously, you're going to have to damage like the defensive bastions and the guns that are going to attack you and everything. But you need to take it. It's like taking a ship.
Don't destroy the fucking planet. Yeah.
Right.
Do as little damage to the enemy's ship as you can, because the entire point of piracy is take the other ship. Now you've got two.
Right.
Yeah. It's way cheaper to take the other dude's shit than build a new one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A full-scale invasion of the planet was now inescapable. All that was left to the Alpha Legion was the how. The long slog of siegecraft and the bloody grind of attrition was anathema to them. And in this case, either would play right into the defenders' hands as they sat on a huge stockpile of munitions and war machines. There's no point of sieging a dude who has more supplies than you. Plus, they were here to take the planet intact, not drag it into an apocalyptic conflict. Even as the second wave of Alpha Legion ships approached, the Mechanicum began to react, void shields snapping into place and the Titans marching forth from the deep forge fanes in the mountains of the Southern Pole. The 77th Grand Battalion of the Iron Warriors Legion had also landed and deployed in mass in support of the Paramar Nexus, and Perturabo's sons were well known for their skills in fortification. Speed was all that was left to Alpha Legion Harrowmast Armelius Dynite, and he ordered his closest ships to burn their drives well beyond safe parameters, in order to press the attack as swiftly as possible. The slower and more massive vessels of the Dark Mechanicum were roughly pulled into gravity grapples and dragged on in their wake. While the tactic cost Dinant ships, both those lost and those damaged, it closed the gap between the Alpha Legion's second wave and the planet with frightening speed. Torpedo salvos launched from the still de-accelerating assault fleet before it had even made orbit, as below lasers and countermeasure missiles streaked into the void to meet the attack. The skies over Paramar became a blazing pattern of kaleidoscopic fire, only a handful of the Alpha Legion's weapons even piercing the stratosphere. But the barrage had served its purpose, as the world was now blinded to all but what they currently attacked, and the fleet was now close enough to open up with its batteries of lance weapons. He threw a giant flak screen into their sky, knowing that they would launch their countermeasures, and their countermeasures would just choke it even more.
Now everything's really starting to ramp up, I guess you would say, right? Between the Iron Warriors and the Alpha Legion, the rest of the forces are essentially coming in.
So a Grand Battalion is essentially a company.
Yeah.
Not a company, a chapter. So a chapter is 1,000 Marines. So there's roughly 1,000 Iron Warriors there. And there's probably honestly more. I would imagine that a Grand Battalion is probably a little bit bigger than a normal one. And it's five ships. So
it's probably all the support vehicles, the dreadnoughts, like the stuff you normally don't count.
I would imagine there's probably 750 Marines on Tyke's Lament, and then each of the escorts probably has 500 Marines, and then all their support vehicles and everything. So it's a pretty big force, but they are dwarfed by the amount of Skitarii that are on the planet. Because remember, the mechanic, this is also a Mechanicum military world. So and 37 planets worth of resources and two penal populations, you can make Skitarii as often as you want.
Yeah, plus, I mean, this is all in space. This is all void battle. It's not, you know, space so marine far. Boots on the ground. Yeah, well.
Yeah. So far, this is everybody attacking the surface of the planet. And the Iron Warriors are now underneath the Mechanicum shields. They're basically ready to defend the Panopticon when the second wave hits.
They ran behind the walls to defend the fortification.
Yeah.
They're five ships. You know, it's one battle cruiser style, or one. The Tyke's Lament is the biggest ship, and that's a battle cruiser, and everything else is an escort. So it's not like a battle barge and a bunch of heavy cruisers. It's a heavy cruiser and a bunch of escorts, essentially.
Yeah.
So they would not stand a chance against 100 Alpha Legion escorts or frigates. And there's just too many of them at the end of the day. They may have been able to take out a couple, but they're not going to last that long. So they land and lend their, whatever you want to say, siege expertise to the fortifying the Panopticon and everything else. And again, these Iron Warriors are probably, as kind of Chuck was getting at earlier, are probably a little bit closer to Imperial Fists anyway, because they've been in a besieged system for 40 years. They haven't been the guys breaking the siege. They've been the guys building the defenses. They've been building up and fighting against these Xenos for a long time. So they're probably a little bit more used to, okay, we got to bulk up your defenses. Like, that's their first plan.
Or a little bit better, like a rotating defense too.
Yeah. With the barrage of the planet reaching a fever pitch, three Alpha Legion strike frigates swept in unthinkably low. They're 3 kilometer long ships rending through the firestorm and into the thin atmosphere, their passage igniting the very air about them. Skimming above the ground at only a few hundred meters, they unleashed their own weapons. These weapons were meant for use in void combat, and they shattered the planet's surface, unleashing a torrent of atomic fire as they systematically targeted laser defenses and ground installations in a slashing arc across the southern polar region, clearing the ground as they were the hand of some vengeful god. These defenses were intended to strike targets tens of thousands of kilometers away, and they struggled vainly as they died. Even so, the torturous stress of this attack took its toll, and the first of these frigates fell from the sky, its weapons still firing as it came apart, its superstructure disintegrating under the gravitational forces it fought against. The second toppled backwards as it once more tried to make it into orbit, its engines failing before it plunged into the planet like a dagger, shattering a mountain as it fell. The last did manage to escape, tearing back through the raging firestorm at the edge of the void, but it bled debris and plasma from its torn and shredded hull. However, the suicidal mission had achieved its goal, for a gap had been slashed through the planet's ground defenses, a gap 40 kilometers to the south of the Paramar Nexus, a gap fought by Dynet's Gambit, and a place where the next hammer strike of the Alpha Legion would fall. And it's with Paramar 5's future in question that we will wrap up this episode. We will be back next week with the conclusion of this conflict before we continue down the timeline of the Horus Heresy.
Getting real tired of your shit, Ron. Getting real tired of this shit.
Do you remember the episode of Battlestar Galactica where they jump a Galactica, like they warp jump, they faster than light jump the Galactica into like 50 meters above the planet for some crazy maneuver?
Yeah, I think so. It's been a while.
This totally made me think of that.
Think of that fight.
Yeah, that fight. And I mean, like, think of it. These frigates are designed for space combat.
Right.
And their offensive weapons are fire and forget. So they blare within 100 meters of the planet, and they just fire fucking everything into the ground underneath them. They're kind of targeting the defensive installations, but when you're unleashing weapons that are meant to tear into the hull of a ship, destroying a mountain around a laser battery underneath the shields that are supposed to be protecting it, not that big of a deal.
Right. Yeah.
The weapons that they're firing on cannot target anything in atmosphere. They're not designed to. All of the atmospheric anti-aircraft stuff is designed to fight aerospace craft, like single fighters or small assault craft.
Like flak.
So the fact that these like fucking 3 kilometer long daggers are just unleashing broadsides into the side of the planet is unthinkable. Like, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's kind of like Thanos's ship on Earth. Like, we have things to, you know, anti-air to take out fighters and shit like that, but we don't have anything.
Yeah, we're not like gonna be able to touch that thing. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
What am I supposed to do with this? Thanks. My missile can shine blow some up lights another at little plane.
Say hello.
My little missile is designed to blow up another plane, not a fucking starship.
Nice callback to Independence Day there, Mark. You're not leaving it alone.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right, Chuck. It's just like, what are you going to do? Especially when the guns are designed to like, oh, a ship just entered system and we don't like it. An Eldari ship just entered system. We don't like it. Shoot our lasers from Paramar 5 at it. Like, that's what those guns are designed for. They're definitely not designed to deal with, oh, the guy's right outside. Not even right outside. The guy's in that. The call is coming from inside the house.
It's like in the Hunt for Red October when they're like, pull the safety measures. It's like here. Oh my here God, it comes. But the safety measures, just fucking pull them. I know they're close.
Right. U571.
I want it armed while it's in the torpedo bay. Like, I want the chance of it to explode while I launch it.
I don't
it.
Know why, but I'm now thinking of U571 when the German guy's listening and he goes, splooshes. Like, I get that it's just the German word, but like, anytime any submarine stuff I ever hear always makes me think of the German guy in U571, like in a very serious, like scared look going, splooshes. It's like, dude, really? Could you have chosen a word other than sploosh?
It was probably a little worse than sploosh when that dagger came hammering in.
Wow, that phallic 3 meter long spaceship came hammering in.
Deep penetration, just like I said.
It's like, again, it's not what I signed up for, but I guess it's happening.
For extra,
give me some more imperial creds. Give me some more imperial creds. What is it, three, six, and nine?
To tell itself.
Give me three, six, or nine imperial creds and. We'll be able to handle this.
Yeah, the planet's going to be sore in the morning for sure.
I hope you got some ointment for that.
So we'll be back next episode with The Coming Storm Part 3, where we'll cover the end of the conflict at Paramar 5, and we will get into some of the conflicts of 007.M31. If you want to get into contact with us about any of our episodes or the show itself, you can do that through email at underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com.
Also, feel free to join our community on Discord. There we talk about lore, hobby, and tactics of Warhammer 40K. Also, feel free to check out other topics such as Warhammer, Age of Sigmar, Magic the Gathering, role-playing games, video games, and much more. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, or at our website, underthehiveofmadness.com. Spelling and links should be in the show notes.
Help our podcast grow by liking and reviewing us wherever you get your podcast fix. Our home is here on Spotify, but we are also available on Apple, Google, Audible, and many more. You can also directly support us through Patreon at www.patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. All Patreon members get access to a video podcast where I butcher the English language. You also get to see our faces and whatever we're looking at on screen. Also, you get access to our quarterly painting contest. We are trying to get that back up and running. We already had one. However, it came at a weird time of the year, so we're probably going to go ahead and relaunch the exact same one and just give everybody some time to paint. Plus, we've got perks at higher levels, such as monthly giveaways. So if any of that stuff strikes your fancy, head on over and check it out. Your beacon in the barren wastes of bad taste. An oasis away from the monotony of the Administratum-approved music channels. It's the Cracked Elysium. Keep up to date with all of your favorite electro-death, grind-screech, and synthcore shows by subscribing to their new feed. The cascade of sound designed to blow out your dad's favorite speakers. We are the Screeching Vengeance of Truth, 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Reminding all of you Chemrats, I've mice and sump ghoulies to keep those dials fixed right here. Same ratty frequency for a dose of the same ratty ass attitude.
In the depths they lurk where darkness creeps. Beware the emperors with arms that weep. Four-armed emperors in glooms they sway, in their grasp we're led astray. Round and round in shadows we spin, from their gaze we cannot win. But heed this warning, hold fast your light, for in their presence all fades to night. Motherfuckers.
Well, read a book. That's all I gotta say.
Allegedly.